vacuumed up her chin in the process. She opened her mouth and looked across the desk at him, waiting. He shrugged.
Cool name. It's got a good hard sound to it.
He pressed a button on the phone.
You work out?
She smiled. Pilates.
It shows.
He said into the phone,
Bring the keys over to the office, Ash.
He hung up. He handed her license back to her.
Should be just a minute.
The relief flooded her body like a broken fever until he reached into a drawer and said,
Just a quick signature.
He slid a signature card across the desk to her.
You still use these things? She said lightly.
As long as the old man is still with us.
He looked up at the ceiling.
And thank God he is, as I say every day.
Well, he built all this.
He didn't build it. My grandfather did. He just...
His voice trailed off.
Whatever.
He unclipped a Mont Blanc from his shirt pocket and handed it across the desk to her.
If you do the honors.
Thankfully, she hadn't returned her license to her wallet. It was on the desk by her elbow. She'd learned last night, through 2 hours of practice, that even when the signature was right side up, particularly when it was right side up, the only way to duplicate it was by seeing it as a shape. Last night, she'd also done best when she'd taken it all in with one quick glance and then plunged straight into duplicating it without pause. But that had been last night, at the kitchen table in Woonsocket, without any stakes. I am enough. She looked at the license, drank in the signature, and put the tip of the Mont Blanc to the signature card. She was halfway through the signature when the door flew open behind her. She didn't look back. She finished writing. Ashley came around to Manfred's side of the desk and handed him a key ring. She remained by his side and stared down at Rachel as if she knew her name wasn't Nicole, as if she could see the clips that held her wig in place. Manfred went through the key ring until he found the one he liked. He noticed Ashley beside him.
Are you on break?
Sorry, Manny.
Thank you for the keys, but we have a bank to run.
Ashley smiled at him in such a way that Rachel knew he'd pay for it later, and just like that, Rachel knew they were fucking, which may or may not be news to the blank-faced wife in the pictures, but probably would be to the two hopeful, pudgy boys in the same photos. As Ashley left, Rachel decided Manny cheated on the wife because of her blankness, but he cheated on his sons because they were fat. And you don't even know it, do you, you son of a bitch? Because you have no integrity. So vows, the ones you made in a church or the ones you should have made to yourself, mean nothing. He didn't even glance at the signature card before he came out from behind the desk.
Let's go then, shall we?
When they exited the office, the girl had left the waiting area. Had she been waiting on a boyfriend or a girlfriend, perhaps? They'd agreed to meet here because her lover had some banking to do before they could pop over to the Chili's across the road. She wasn't in the bank any longer, at least not the parts Rachel could see. So that was it. Boyfriend or girlfriend came to meet her, and they were now ordering the tequila lime chicken across the road. Or, scenario number two, she'd ID'd Rachel, texted Ned, Lars, or men like them, and now she was driving home with plausible deniability in her pocket. Should the police ever question her about the woman in the blonde wig who'd been assassinated in the parking lot around 10:15 that morning? Manny stopped before an 8-foot-high vault door. He stepped in close to a keypad and punched some numbers onto it. He took one step to his left and pressed his thumb to another pad. The vault door clicked open. He pulled it back. Now they faced a gate. He unlocked that with one of the keys on his ring and then led her into the vault. They stood there, surrounded by safe deposit boxes, and she realized she'd never asked Brian for the number. And he'd never told her. How do you spend hours teaching someone how to fake a signature, weeks, if not months, prepping for this worst-case scenario, make fake IDs, fake passports, pick the perfect bank, and still not tell your wife the actual fucking number of the actual safe deposit box? Men.
In case you want privacy.
Manny had been talking to her. She followed his gaze to a black door on her left.
Did you use the privacy room last time you were here?
No, she heard herself say. I didn't.
Will you need it today?
Yes. There had to be 600 boxes in here. For a small former farming community, what were people putting in here? Recipes for peach cobbler? Daddy's Timex?
Well,
Manny said. Well. He led her to the middle wall. She reached into her bag for the key, held it between her index and thumb, felt the numbers there. She dropped it into her palm, 865, as Manny inserted his own key into the box marked 865. She placed her key in the other lock, and they turned them together. He withdrew the box, rested it along his left forearm.
You said you would be needing privacy?
Yes. He indicated the door with a jut of his chin, and she opened it. The room beyond was tiny, nothing in there but four steel walls, a table, two chairs, and thin white shafts of recessed lighting. Manny placed the box on the table. He looked directly at her, with their bodies only inches apart, and she realized the asshole was actually hoping for a moment, as if his charms were so universal and magnetic, women had no choice but to act like porn stars in his presence. I'll be out in a few minutes. She moved around to the other side of the table and slipped her bag off her shoulder.
Of course, of course. See you out there.
She didn't even indicate she heard him, and only looked back up again once he'd closed the door behind him. She opened the box. Inside, as promised, was the messenger bag she'd seen Brian enter the bank with 4 days ago. Had it only been that long, it felt like 1,000 years in her rear view. She wrenched the bag out of the tight space and held it by the handles as it unfurled. The cash was on top, as he'd said it would be, stacks of $100 and, in one case, $1,000 bills, neatly rubber-banded together. She transferred them to her bag. All that was left were the 6 passports. She reached in and pulled them out, and a small bit of bile and vomit reached her mouth when she saw that there were only 5 of them. No. No, 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 no. She beseeched the recessed lighting and the cold steel walls. Please, no. Don't do this to me. Not now. Not after I've come this far. Please. Hold it together, Rachel. Look at the passports before you lose all hope. She opened the first one. Brian's face stared back at her. His latest alias was there as well. Hewitt. Timothy. She opened the next one. Caleb's. His alias had been Branch, Seth. Her hands shook when she reached for the third passport, shook so bad she had to stop for a moment and clench them into fists and then press the fists together and breathe, breathe, breathe. She opened the third passport, saw the name first, Carmichael Lindsay, and then the photograph, Nicole Alden. She opened the fourth passport, Branch, Kyoko. Haya stared back at her. She opened the fifth and final one. The babies. She didn't scream or throw anything or kick over a chair. She sat on the floor and placed her hands over her eyes and stared into the darkness of herself. I've watched my life away, she thought. I've failed to act at every step of the way, and I've justified that by claiming I was here to bear witness. But in reality, I was just choosing not to act. Until now. And look what that's gotten me. I am alone, and then I die. All else is window dressing, wrapping paper, sales and marketing. She found a pack of Kleenex at the bottom of her bag, passed the stacks of money, and used a couple of tissues on her face. She found herself staring back in the bag, the money taking up the left side, and on the right, her keys, her wallet, the gun. And as long as she stared at it, and it could have been 10 minutes or 1, she had no idea, she knew in the end she could never point a gun at him and pull the trigger a second time. She didn't have it in her. She was going to let him go. Without his passport, fuck him, that was staying here, and without his money, because she was walking off with that. But she couldn't kill him. And why? Because, God help her, she loved him. Or at least the illusion of him, at least that.
the illusion of how he'd made her feel, and not just during the false happiness of their marriage, but even in these last few days. She would rather have known the lie that was Brian than the truth of anything else in her life. She dropped the pack of tissues back into her bag and pushed the sack of money in over it, and that's when she saw the flash of dark blue vinyl. It slipped out between two stacks of bills like a card used to cut the deck. She pulled it out of the bag. It was a United States passport. She opened it. Her own face stared back at her, one of the photos taken that rainy Saturday in the Galleria Mall 3 weeks ago. The face of a woman who was trying hard to look strong, but hadn't gotten all the way there yet. But she was trying. She put all six passports into her bag with the money and left the room. Chapter 34. The Dance. Leaving the bank, she again looked for the woman with the neck tats and the perfect posture, but if she was in the building, she wasn't anywhere Rachel could see her. She turned right past the waiting area and saw Manny behind the teller's window, speaking to Ashley with his chin tilted toward her shoulder. They both looked up as she turned left at the door, Manny's mouth opening as if he were about to call after her, but she went through the front door and into the parking lot. Now she had the perfect angle on the cars under the tree, and the sun was cooperating too. Of the four cars that remained, only one was clearly occupied. It was the Chevy that had backed into its spot, and a man sat behind the wheel. It was still too shady to see his features, but it was definitely a man's head, squared off at the top and at the jaw, ears the size of change purses. No way to tell if he was there to kill her or survey her, or if he was simply a middle manager ducking out on his work, a John getting a blowjob, or an out-of-town salesman who'd arrived early for an appointment to beat the traffic that clogged I-95 in Providence between 8 and 10. She looked straight ahead as she passed between the employee of the month's car and a van parked in the handicap spot. It, too, had backed in, the sliding door by her left shoulder now, and she imagined the sound it would make as it was pulled open and hands reached out and yanked her inside. She passed the van, and a long black SUV approached from her right. She watched with a strangely detached fascination as the driver's tinted window slid down and the driver thrust his arm through the opening even before the window had completed its journey down into the door slot. He wore a dark suit with a white shirt cuff peeking out at the wrist. She hadn't thought to reach into her bag for the gun or at least try to run back behind the van for cover before his arm reached full extension, a cigarette nestled between the index and middle fingers as he exhaled a grateful plume of smoke, his head pressed against the headrest. He shot her a lazy grin as he passed, as if to say, "It's all about the little pleasures, ain't it?" After he rolled past, she put her hand in her bag, thumbed the safety off the P380, and kept her hand there as she reached the Range Rover. She opened the door with her left hand and climbed inside, put the bag on the front passenger seat and the gun on the console beside her, fingers still on the trigger, safety off. She said, "You still there?"
"Had a few birthdays while you were gone," he said mildly. "Fucking took you so long."
"Really?" She removed her finger from the trigger, thumbed the safety back on, and put the gun in the space between her seat and the console. "That's my greeting?"
"Gosh, hon, you look beautiful. Is that a new something? You look like you dropped a few pounds, too. Not that you ever needed to."
"Fuck you," she said, surprised to hear a chuckle trail the words. He laughed.
"My bad. How'd everything go? Should probably start the engine, by the way, and do the phone trick if we're going to keep talking."
She turned the car on. "Couldn't they assume I'm going hands-free on the cell?"
"You're not wearing a headset, and you're driving a car from 1992.
She put the phone to her ear.
"Touché. Was there a plant in the bank?"
She pulled out of the slot, turned toward the exit. "Hard to tell. There was a girl in the waiting area I'm still unsure about."
"How about the parking lot?"
"One guy in a car in the employee section. Couldn't tell if he was watching us or not." She reached the road.
"Turn right," Brian said.
They drove up a mild incline and then passed a cluster of clapboard houses, most red, a few blue, the rest faded to the brown-gray of old baseballs. Once they passed the houses, they hit a straightaway between two pastures that unfurled for miles. The sky that rose before her was a blue she'd seen only in dreams and old Technicolor movies. A bank of white clouds formed in the southeast corner, but cast no shadow on the fields. She could see why Brian had chosen this road. There were no crossroads for miles. What was left of Johnston's farming community, it appeared, was right here.
"Well?" Brian said after about 2 miles.
"Well, what?" She laughed for some reason.
"You see anyone in the rear view?"
She glanced up. The road behind her was a gunmetal ribbon with nothing on it. "No."
"How far back can you see?"
"I'd guess about 2 miles." After another minute, he said,
"Now?"
She looked again. "Nothing. Nobody."
"Rachel."
"Brian."
"Rachel,"
he said again.
"Brian?"
He sat up in the back seat, and the smile that broke across his face was almost too big for the car.
"How do you feel about yourself today?"
he asked.
"Right now. Pretty fucking bad or pretty fucking good?"
She caught his eyes in the rear view and presumed hers were as adrenalized as his. "I feel..."
"Speak it."
"Pretty fucking good." He clapped his hands together and whooped. She stepped on the gas and punched the roof and let out a howl. In another 10 minutes, they reached another small strip mall. She'd clocked it on the way in. It contained a post office, a sub shop, a liquor store, a Marshall's, and a laundromat.
"What are we doing here?"
Brian peered at the low-slung buildings, all gray except for the Marshall's, which was white, fading to eggshell. "I need to run a quick errand."
"Now?"
She nodded.
"Rachel,"
he said, and failed to keep a whiff of condescension out of his voice.
"We don't have time to..."
"Argue?" she said. "I agree. Be right back." She left the key in the ignition and the bag she'd carried out of the bank at his feet. It took her 10 minutes in Marshall's to change out of her Nicole Rosevich outfit and into a pair of jeans, cranberry V-neck tee, and black cashmere cardigan. She handed the tags to the cashier, transferred her previous outfit to a plastic store bag, paid up, and left. Brian watched her exit and started to sit up, but then his face darkened as she gave him a quick forefinger wave and entered the post office. She came back out 5 minutes later. Brian looked a lot paler when she got behind the wheel, smaller too, and a little sickly. Her bag still sat at his feet, but he'd clearly gone through it. A stack of bills peeked through the opening.
"You went through my bag," she said.
"So much for trust."
"Trust?"
It came out sharp and high like a hiccup.
"My passport isn't in there. Neither is yours."
"No."
"So where are they?"
"I have mine," she assured him.
"That's wonderful."
"I think so."
"Rachel."
"Brian." His voice was nearly a whisper.
"Where's my fucking passport?"
She reached into the Marshall's bag and retrieved a shipping label, handed it to him. He smoothed it on his thigh and stared at it for some time.
"What's this?"
"It's a shipping label. Global Express, guaranteed from the United States Postal Service. That's your tracking number right there in the upper right corner."
"I can see that,"
he said.
"I can also see you addressed it to yourself as a guest of the Intercontinental Hotel in Amsterdam."
She nodded. "Is that a good hotel? Have you ever stayed there? It looked good on the website, so I went with it." He looked at her like he was thinking about hitting something. Her, perhaps. Or himself. The dashboard, possibly. Probably her, though.
"What did you mail to the Intercontinental Hotel in Amsterdam, Rachel?"
"Your passport." She started the Range Rover and pulled out of the parking lot.
"What do you mean, my passport?"
His voice was, if possible, even quieter. It was how he got in an argument just before he exploded. "I mean," she said, with the slowness one reserved for very young children, "I mailed your passport to Amsterdam, which is where I plan to be by tomorrow night. You, on the other hand, will still be here in the States."
You can't do this,
he said. She looked over at him. I kinda already did.
You can't do this,
he repeated, but this time he shouted it, and then he punched the ceiling. She waited to see if he'd hit anything else. After a mile or so, she said, Brian, you lied to me through our entire marriage and for the year leading up to it. Did you actually think I was going to overlook that? Say, gosh, you big lug, ya. Thanks for looking out for me. She turned left at a sign for 95, still 10 miles away from the on-ramp.
Turn the fucking car around, he said.
To do what?
Get the passport back.
You can't get mail back once you've handed it over. Something to do with interfering with a civil servant on his appointed rounds or something.
Turn the car around.
What are you going to do? She was surprised to hear a chuckle trail the words. Go back and stick up a post office? I'm going to guess they have cameras, Brian. You may get the passport, but by then you'll have Cotter McCann, the local police, the state police, and, since this would surely be a federal crime, the FB fucking eye on your ass. Is that really the option you most want to explore right now? He glowered at her from the other side of the Range Rover. You hate me right now, she said. He continued to glower. Well, she said, we always hate the things that wake us up. He punched the ceiling again.
Fuck you.
Aw, sweetness, she said. Would you like me to elucidate your remaining options? He popped the glove compartment with the side of his fist and pulled out a pack of cigarettes and a lighter. He lit the cigarette and cracked the window.
You smoke?
She said.
You mentioned options.
She held out her hand. Give me one. He handed her his and lit another one, and they drove the empty road and smoked, and she felt 100 feet tall for a moment.
You can kill me, she said. I'm not a killer,
he said with a weary indignation that fell somewhere between charming and offensive. But if you do, you'll never get your passport. With all the heat on you, even if you could get someone to make you another one, they'd probably charge you a king's ransom and sell you out to Cotter McCann anyway. She looked in his eyes and saw that she'd scored a direct hit. You've got no one left to trust, do you? He flicked his ash out the crack in the window.
That's what you're offering? Trust?
She shook her head. That's what I'm demanding. After a while, he asked,
And what's that look like?
It looks like you scurrying around for a few days like a rat with everyone chasing you, while me, Haya, and A.B. wander the canals of Amsterdam.
You like that image, he said.
And at the appointed time and place, you retrieve the passport I'll have sent back stateside. He sucked so hard on the cigarette the tobacco crackled as it burned.
You can't do this to me.
She flicked her own cigarette out the window. But I already have, dear.
I rescued you, he said.
You what?
From a prison you built for yourself. I spent fucking years getting you ready for this. If that's not love, then what?
You want me to believe you love me? She pulled to the side of the road and slammed the shift into park.
Then get me out of this country, give me access to the money, and trust I'll send you the passport.
She stabbed the air between them with her finger, surprised at the swift appearance and infinite depth of her rage.
Because, Brian, there is no other fucking deal on the table.
He dropped his gaze and looked out at the gray road and blue sky and the fields yellow with the promise of summer. Now, she thought, comes the moment when he threatens you.
Okay,
he said.
Okay, what? I'll give you what you want.
And what's that?
Apparently, he said, everything.
No, she said. Just faith. He gave his own reflection a rueful smile.
Like I said.
Brian texted Haya from the interstate. For the second time in 24 hours, he didn't like her response. As agreed upon, he wrote, How's everything? If everything was all right, she was supposed to write back, Perfect. If anything had gone wrong, she was supposed to respond, Everything's fine. After 15 minutes, she sent a text back. All okay. In Woonsocket, he directed her up the main hill and then south several blocks.
They turned onto a dusty scar of a street that dead-ended at a mound of landfill, crumbled sheetrock, and bent rebar. From there, they had a perfect view of the river and the mill and the night watchman's house. He pulled a pair of binoculars from the glove box and adjusted the focus as he looked down at the house.
"The pantry shade is still up," he said.
The sparrow flapped twice in her chest. He handed the binoculars to her, and she saw for herself. Maybe she forgot.
"Maybe,"
he said. "But you were pretty clear with your instructions."
"But I was pretty clear with my instructions,"
he agreed. They sat and watched the house for a while, passing the binoculars back and forth, looking for movement of any kind. Once, Rachel thought she saw the shade of the far-left window on the second floor move, but she couldn't swear to it. Still, they knew. They knew. Her stomach eddied, and for a moment the Earth's atmosphere felt too thin. After a little more watching, Brian took the wheel, and they drove back down through the neighborhood, and he drove a bit beyond where he had last night and approached the mill from a few blocks farther north. They entered the grounds from an old trucking route that ran parallel to the railroad tracks, and in daylight, the skeleton of the mill was both more pathetic and more resplendent, like the sun-bleached bones of a slaughtered god-king and his once majestic retinue. They found the pickup truck parked a few yards into the shell of the building closest to the river. There was no northern wall left, and most of the second floor was gone. The truck was a beast of a machine, a black full-size Sierra, all hard form and function, its wheels and sides splattered with dried mud. Brian put his hand on the hood.
"It's not hot, but it's a little warm. They haven't been here too long."
"How many?" He looked in the cab.
"Hard to tell. Seats 5, but I doubt they'd bring 5.
"Why?" He shrugged.
"Manpower's expensive."
"So's losing $70 million, she said. He looked around the mill for a bit, and she knew him well enough to know this was how he processed, his eyes clocking his surroundings without actually seeing them.
"You want to confront them?" she said. "I don't want to."
He widened his eyes.
"But I don't see a choice."
"We could skip returning to the house and just run from here." He nodded.
"You're willing to leave Haya and the baby behind?"
"We could call the police. Haya doesn't know anything. She can easily claim ignorance."
"If the police show up, what's to stop the guys inside from shooting Haya and the baby, or shooting the cops, or entering into a standoff with hostages?"
"Nothing," she admitted.
"So do you still want to hit the road? Leave them behind?"
"Do you?"
"Asked you first."
He shot her the tiniest of smiles.
"What's it that asshole said to you in Haiti?
Would you like to be good or would you like to live?" Brian nodded. "Can you get us out of here?" she asked.
"I can get you out of here. Can't get myself out of here the way you've fixed it, but I can get you out, honey bunch."
She ignored the dig. "Right this second?" He nodded.
"Right this second."
"What are our chances?"
"Our chances?"
"My chances," she said.
"About 50-50. Every hour they drop 5% in Cotter McCann's favor. We add a terrified woman and a baby. That's if we can extricate them from guys who know how to use firearms a lot better than we do. Your odds of success drop even further."
"So right now the odds are about even. But if we go up to that house," she pointed at the other end of the mill, "it's more likely we die." His eyes widened a little more, and he nodded repeatedly.
"Way more likely, yeah."
"And if I say I want to run, you'll just take me out of here now?"
"I didn't say that. I said it was an option."
She looked up through the blackened rafters and the shredded roof at the blue sky. "There's no option." He waited. "All 4 of us go." She took several quick breaths, and it made her lightheaded. "Or none of us do."
"Okay,"
he whispered, and she could see he was as terrified as she was.
"Okay."
She dropped the hammer.
"Haya speaks perfect English."
He squinted at her.
"She grew up in California. She was gaming Caleb."
He let loose a high chuckle of disbelief.
Why?
So he'd rescue her from a shitty life, it sounds like. Brian shook his head so many times he resembled a dog after a bath. Then he smiled. The old Brian smile, surprised to be surprised by the turns of the world and somehow tickled at the same time.
Well, shit, he said. I finally like her.
He nodded once.
She told you?
Rachel nodded.
Why?
So we'd know not to abandon her.
I'm not above leaving her behind,
he said simply.
Never was. But I wouldn't leave Caleb's kid up there to die. Not even for 70 million.
He lifted the cover over the tire jack compartment in the Rover and came back with a short, ugly shotgun with a pistol grip. How many guns do you need? She asked. He looked off in the direction of the house as he loaded shells into the gun.
You've seen me shoot. I suck. A shotgun levels the playing field a bit.
He shut the hatchback. Whatever he'd just claimed about being unable to leave Caleb's daughter behind, it didn't alter the fact that he could kill her right now with that ugly weapon. It wouldn't be the rational choice necessarily, but at this point, rational choice was a luxury in the rearview mirror. It didn't seem to be the first thing on his mind, though, so she opened the driver's door of the truck. The floor mat was caked with dried mud. She craned her head over the seat and saw the floor mat on the passenger seat was crusted with the same. Wherever they'd been searching for her or Brian lately, they'd walked through some dirt to do it. She opened the rear driver's side door. The mats back there were pristine. She could still smell the showroom in the rubber. She showed it to Brian. There are only two of them.
Unless the other car's parked somewhere else.
She hadn't considered that. I thought you were Mr. Positive Thinking.
We'll call this an off fucking day, then.
I mean, she started, but couldn't finish the thought. Her hand dropped back to her side. She felt closer to vomiting than she had in a while. She mentioned this to Brian.
Where's a Scientologist when you need one, huh?
He pointed the shotgun down the end of the building, past mounds of dirt and trash and all the pieces of wall that had been torn out when the scavengers came for the copper wire.
Right at the end, there's a set of stairs. You go down them, and you find a really small tunnel.
A tunnel? He nodded.
Caleb and me dug it over the last couple months, when you thought I was out of the country.
Lovely.
Figured if we were ever in that house and we had time to see the opposition coming for us, we'd scoot out, get over here, and make a run for it pretty much from where we're standing now. You can go down.
I can?
We can, yeah. We'll crawl over there and...
How tight is this tunnel?
Oh, it's bad, he said. It's more like a trough. If I ate a pizza right now, I'd probably get stuck in there.
I'm not doing that, she said.
You'd rather die?
He waved the shotgun like it was an extension of his arm. I'd rather die above ground than below it, yes.
You got a better idea?
It came out sharply. I haven't even heard yours. All I've heard is the word tunnel. And point that fucking thing at the ground, would you? He considered the shotgun. He shrugged in apology and pointed it at the ground.
My plan, he said calmly, is that we take the tunnel under the house. We come up in the back bedroom on the first floor. We come out into the house while they're peeking out the windows for us.
And what's to stop them from shooting us, then?
We'll have the drop on them.
The drop? She said.
Yes.
They're professionals. A good man with a gun can't defeat a bad man with a gun if the bad man is at ease in violent confrontation and the good man is not.
Fine, he said. Your turn.
What?
Your turn, he repeated. Give me a better idea.
She took a minute. It was hard to think over the terror, hard for any word to find space in her brain besides run. She told him her idea. When she finished, he chewed his lower lip and then the inside of his mouth and then his upper lip.
It's good.
You think? He stared at her, as if judging how honest he could afford to be.
No.
He eventually admitted.
It's not. But it's better than mine.
She stepped up close to him. There's one big problem with it.
which is?
If you don't do your part, I'm dead within a minute. He said,
maybe even less.
She took a step back and flipped him the bird. So how do I know you'll hold up your end? He pulled the pack of cigarettes from his jacket pocket and offered her one. She waved it off. He put one between his lips, lit it, and returned the pack to his pocket.
Be seeing you, Rachel.
He gave her a small shrug and walked off through the mill toward the night watchman's house and never looked back. Chapter 35 Family Photo. She drove the Range Rover along the train tracks that ran between the mills and the river. She left the tracks just past the last red brick building and bounced over cinder block and boulders and hoped that none of the things scraping the underside of the vehicle was strong enough or angled in such a way that it could puncture the gas tank. She bounced along until she found the little road Brian had described, and then she was clinging to the backside of the hill that led up to the night watchman's house. Near the top, she stood on the gas and lurched up and over the ridge, the Rover tilting hard to the left, so hard she feared she'd tip over, so she went against her natural instincts and pressed down even harder on the gas, and the vehicle slammed back down on all four wheels and shot up into the clearing behind the house. Both Ned and Lars came out on the back porch. They were armed. Ned cocked his head at her in surprise, but also triumph, a look in his small eyes that she'd seen plenty of times in her life, a look that never failed to make her feel tiny and yet outraged at the same time. Stupid girl. She put the Rover in park and stepped out of it, keeping it between her and the porch.
"Don't run," Ned said. "We'll just have to chase you, and the story will end the same way, but with us just a bit more fucking perturbed."
Ned had the Glock he'd killed Caleb with in his hand, the silencer already attached. The soundtrack of her death, she feared, would be a soft Then again, Lars cradled a large hunting rifle, the kind she imagined could take down a bear, so maybe her death would come with a bang. They both walked off the porch at the same time. She pointed her pistol across the hood at them and said, "Stay there." Ned held up his hands, looked over at Lars.
"I think she's got us."
Was Brian somewhere safe, watching the scene play out with a smile on his face? Lars kept walking toward the Rover, but he did so on a diagonal line, and so did Ned, but in the opposite direction, so that each step they took brought them closer to her, yet farther from each other.
"Fucking stop!"
Lars sauntered a few more steps before he did. It was quite possible Brian kept a backup passport. He could just let her die and go spend all the money.
"What's this?"
Ned said.
"Red light, green light?"
He took two steps toward her. "Brian," she wanted to scream. "Brian!" She extended her arm across the hood.
"I said stop!"
"You didn't say red light."
He took another step.
"Stop!"
Her voice bounced off the house and echoed down the hill. Ned's voice stayed level and smooth.
"Rachel, you've seen some movies, I'm sure, where little girls with guns hold off big bad guys with guns. But honey, it doesn't work that way in real life. You let us come off that porch, and then you let us get meaningful separation from each other. Which means that now, in this real life of ours, you can't shoot both of us before one of us shoots you. Instead, I'll shoot you, or he will, and it's not going to be real hard to pull off."
"Brian, Jesus, where the fuck are you? Did you abandon me?" Her hand shook enough that she placed her elbow to the hood of the Rover to steady it. She pointed the gun at Ned, but that left her unable to cover Lars. Ned cocked an eyebrow at her elbow vibrating off the hood.
"See what I'm talking about?"
"Oh, shit. 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 Did you forsake me?" Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Lars take two more steps.
"Please," she said. "Just don't move."
Ned smiled at that. "Checkmate." From upstairs, the baby cried. Lars looked up at the sound.
Ned kept his eyes on Rachel. And Brian stepped out on the porch, leveled the shotgun, and pulled the trigger. The blast entered Lars's back. It exited his front while the rifle was still in his arms. Pieces of buckshot and pieces of Lars hit the passenger side of the Rover, and the rifle left his arms and landed on the hood. Lars went to his knees, and she shot Ned. She couldn't actually remember squeezing the trigger, but she must have, because he shouted as if he were shouting at a ref making a bad call at a sporting event. A dismayed and disgusted, "Ah!" And then he toppled back against the porch steps, and she could see the gun was no longer in his hand. She came around the Rover, kept the gun pointed at him. He watched her come, watched Brian come too, pointing that shotgun at him. Brian's arm shook. Hers, to her surprise, did not anymore, but it didn't much matter when you were talking about a shotgun. Lars made a soft thud when his face planted in the dirt. She picked up Ned's gun. She held on to it and put her own in the waistband of her jeans. Then they were both standing in front of him, wondering what they were going to do. The hole she'd put in Ned was in his shoulder. His left arm drooped, as if there were nothing to hold it up anymore, so she presumed her bullet had shattered his collarbone. He looked at her, breathing shallowly through his mouth. He looked forlorn and lost, a salesman at the end of a bad week. The blood spread down his off-white shirt and soaked the left side of his jacket, one of those plaid, fleece-lined shirt jackets a lot of construction workers wear.
"Where's your cell phone?"
Brian said. Ned grimaced as he reached into the right pocket of his corduroy pants. He handed Brian a flip phone. Brian opened it, scrolled through the call log, and then the texts.
"When did you arrive?"
he asked.
"About 9,
Ned said. Brian opened one of his texts.
"You told someone, we got C. What's that mean?" "Perloff's wife was Objective C. You're Objective A."
He gave Rachel a weary flick of the head.
"She's B."
The baby wailed again, muffled by glass and distance.
"Where's Haya?"
Rachel said.
"Tied up upstairs,"
Ned said.
"Same room as the baby. Baby's in the crib, and she's not climbing out age yet. They're not going anywhere."
Brian rechecked the call log, and then the texts again. He pocketed the phone.
"No texts or calls since 9:30. Why?" "Nothing to report. We were waiting on you, Brian. Didn't think you'd show."
"What's your name?" Rachel asked.
"What difference does it make?"
Ned said. Rachel couldn't argue the point one way or the other. Brian said,
"How'd you find this place?"
Ned blinked a few times, hissed at the pain as he adjusted his position on the steps.
"Dummy corpse docks on your partner's laptop. Same company that rented the mining probes out of Jakarta 2 years ago bought this place. Where else are you looking?" "Sorry,"
Ned said.
"Even if I could help you, and I'd probably serve up everything I know for a bottle of water right now, I'm only looped in on what applies to my project and my department, no one else's."
Rachel retrieved a bottle of water from the Rover, went to hand it to Ned, but he was struggling one-handed with his wallet, thumbing out a photograph. He dropped the wallet to the porch. Now, if she really wanted to know, she could pick it up and look at his license to learn his name. She left it there. He handed her the photograph as he took the bottle of water. It was of a blonde girl, maybe 11 or 12, with a wide chin, big eyes, and an uncertain smile, her arm slung around a brown-haired boy, a couple years younger, with Ned's small lips and wide nose, the boy's smile bigger and more confident than his sister's.
"Those are my kids."
Brian looked over.
"Put that fucking thing away."
Ned held Rachel's eyes, went on like Brian hadn't spoken.
"Kaylee, that's my girl. She's real smart, you know. She's founded the Big Buddies program in her school. That's where..."
"Stop," Rachel said.
"Where the older kids, like her, they mentor the first and second graders, you know, buddy up with them so they're not scared. It was Kaylee's idea. She's got a huge heart."
"Stop,"
Rachel said again. Ned gulped some water.
And, Jacob, that's my boy, he...
Brian pointed the shotgun at Ned.
Shut the fuck up! Okay.
Ned spilled a bunch of water on his lap. He thought Brian was going to pull the trigger.
Okay, okay.
She watched him tremble as he drank more water, and she tried willing her heart to calcify and shrivel, but she failed. Ned drank a bit more water and licked his lips several times.
Thank you, Rachel.
Suddenly, she didn't want to meet his eyes.
My name,
he said to her,
is...
Don't you do it, she whispered.
Don't.
Now she met his eyes, and he met hers, and he looked at her a long time, long enough for her to see both the little boy and the terrible man inside him. Then he flicked his eyelids in acquiescence. Brian walked to the edge of the hill, cocked his arm, and threw Ned's cell phone in a high arc that ended when it splashed into the river. He spoke with his back to them.
What are we going to do with you, man? I've been thinking about that.
Brian turned.
I bet you have. You're not killers.
Brian tilted his head toward Lars.
Your road dog there might debate that point. He had a gun on your wife. He was an immediate threat. You did what you had to do. That's different than executing someone. So, so different.
What would you do if you were us? Rachel asked.
Oh, you'd already be dead,
Ned said.
But I forked over my soul a long time ago, Rachel. You still have yours.
Ned adjusted himself on the stairs again.
Whether you kill me or you tie me up, it'll add up to the same thing. The company's going to send a second team, if they haven't already. They don't give a shit about me. I'm just a fucking coolie. If they find me alive or they find me dead, the story is still the same. They continue to hunt you. They might get me to a doctor or not, but they will continue pursuit of you. My point is, you leave me alive, the end result is the same as it would be if you kill me. Except if you kill me in cold blood, you've got to look in the mirror every night.
Brian and Rachel considered that, considered each other. Ned stood slowly, using the column to the right of the broken railing to do so.
Hey,
Brian said.
If I'm going to die, I'd rather be standing.
Brian looked wildly at Rachel, and she looked wildly back. Ned was right. Shooting him and Lars had been easy when there'd been no time to think about it. But now? Upstairs, the baby howled. It was shriller this time, more frenzied. Brian said,
That doesn't sound right. You want to check on her?
Rachel didn't know shit about checking on a baby. She'd never even babysat. And the thought of being up there, trapped if something went wrong down here, was more terrifying than standing guard. I'll stay with him. Brian nodded.
He moves, you fucking shoot him.
Easy for you to say.
You bet,
she said. Brian went up the steps and put the shotgun barrel under Ned's chin.
Don't fuck with her.
Ned said nothing, just kept his eyes on something in the general vicinity of the blown-out mills. Brian entered the house. The moment he was gone, she felt half as strong and twice as weak. Ned wavered in place against the post. He dropped the water bottle and looked about to keel over, but kept his balance by slapping his wrist into it at the last second.
You're losing too much blood,
Rachel said.
I'm losing too much blood.
Ned agreed.
Could I ask you for the water?
She went to pick up the water, but stopped. She caught him watching her, and for the briefest of seconds, he looked far less helpless. He looked hungry and ready to pounce.
The water,
he said. Get it yourself. He let out a groan and reached for the bottle, his fingers pawing at the wood riser just above it. A window opened above them, and several things happened in the same 2 or 3 second span. Brian called,
They killed Haya!
Ned surged off the porch and rammed the top of his head into her chest. Ned reached for her gun. Rachel jerked her gun hand free. Ned drove his good shoulder into Rachel's chin. Brian called, Shoot him! Rachel pulled the trigger and fell to the ground. Ned came off her body, and she heard him grunt, and she fired the pistol again. The first time she fired at nothing, it was purely defense. The next shot, as she rolled, she aimed in the direction of Ned's legs as they scrabbled away from her. She fired the final shot as she came to her knees, fired in the direction of his ass as he reached the top of the incline. He dove over the hill, and she may or may not have heard him make a sound when she'd fired that third shot, a yelp, possibly, or she'd imagined it. She got to her feet and ran to the edge of the hill, and she saw him down at the bottom on his knees. She jumped into the brush and the high grass and the weeds and the bottles and old burger wrappers and came down the hill with the gun held high by her right ear. Ned was on his feet now, staggering toward the first brick building. By the time she reached the bottom of the hill, he was holding a hand to his belly and lurching as he walked, and he made it to an old office chair with rusted legs and a rusted metal frame. Someone had slashed a horizontal line across the seat, and the foam that spilled out was brown. Ned sat in it and watched her come. Her phone vibrated. She put it to her ear.
"You okay?"
Brian asked.
"Yeah."
She looked back up the hill at him standing on the back porch, the baby to his shoulder, the shotgun in his other hand.
"You need me?"
"No," she said. "I got this."
"They shot her in the head."
Brian's voice was thick.
"In the room with the baby."
"Okay," she said. "It'll be okay, Brian. I'll be right back."
"Hurry,"
he said.
"Why'd you have to kill her?"
she asked Ned when she reached him. He pressed a hand to the exit wound. One of her bullets, she had no idea which one, had entered his body somewhere in the back and come out by his right hip.
"Performance bonus,"
he said. What came out of her mouth sounded like a laugh.
"What did you say?"
He nodded.
"Our hourly rate is for shit. We're incentive-based."
His head lolled as he looked around at the husk of the mill.
"My old man worked in a place like this up in Lowell."
"Cotter McCann could turn this into an apartment complex or a mall," she said. "A casino, for Christ's sake. Make their $70 million back in a year."
He gave that a weary raise of the eyebrows.
"Land is probably poisoned."
"What do they care?"
She was hoping, if she kept talking, he would just fucking bleed out in front of her.
"By the time people start getting sick, they'll have pulled their money back out and be long gone."
He gave that some thought and half nodded, half shrugged.
"She didn't know anything. She barely spoke English."
"Police have translators,"
he said.
"And she spoke English just fine in the last few minutes. Believe it."
He was turning gray, but the hand he pressed the wound still looked firm and strong. He gave her puppy dog eyes full of apology.
"I don't make the rules, Rachel. I don't control anything. I just do a job to put food on my family's table, and I sit up some nights just like every other parent, hoping my kids' lives will be better than mine was, that they'll have more options than I did."
She followed his gaze around the mill.
"You think they will?"
"No."
He shook his head. He looked down at the blood soaking into his lap, and his voice cracked.
"I think those days are over."
"Funny," Rachel said. "I'm starting to wonder if they ever existed at all." Ned heard something in her voice that made him look up. The last thing he said was,
"Hold on."
She aimed at his chest from 3 feet away, but her arm was shaking so badly when she pulled the trigger that the bullet entered his neck. He went rigid against the back of the chair for a moment and panted like a parched dog and blinked at the sky. His lips moved, but no sound came out. The blood pooled in the hollow of his throat and dripped into the crevices between the chair frame and the cushions. He stopped blinking. His lips stopped moving. Rachel walked back up the hill. Brian stood with Annabelle to his shoulder. Her eyes were closed, her lips slightly parted. She was sleeping.
"You want to have kids?"
she asked him.
"What?"
"Simple question."
"Yes,"
Brian said to her.
"I want to have kids."
"Beyond this one?" she said.
Because I think she's ours now, Brian.
Ours?
Yes.
I don't have a passport.
No, you don't. But you have our kid. Do you want another?
If I live?
If you live, she conceded.
Yes,
he said. Do you want to have kids with me? Rachel asked.
Well, who else?
Brian said. Say the words.
I want to have kids with you,
Brian said.
No one else.
Why no one else?
Because I don't love anyone else, Rachel. Never have.
Oh.
I want a few, actually.
Brian nodded.
Kids.
A few.
A few.
You going to birth them?
Already playing the violin for herself,
he said to the child on his shoulder.
Get a load of her.
She looked at the house. I'm going to say goodbye to Haya.
You don't have to go in there.
Yes, I do. I have to pay my respects.
They blew her head off, Rachel.
She winced. Haya had pursued a desire to be anyone but what the world had fated her to be with such fierce resolve that Rachel, having only met the real Haya a few hours before, didn't want to see her with half her face turned to pulp, lying in a gout of black blood. But if she didn't look, then Haya was just another of the disappeared in Rachel's rear view. Soon it would grow too easy to pretend she'd never been real. If it's ever within your power to do so, she considered saying aloud to Brian, but didn't. You have to bear witness to your dead. You simply have to. You have to step into the energy field of whatever remains of their spirit, their soul, their essence, and let it pass through your body. And in the passing, maybe a wisp of it adheres to you, grafts itself to your cells. And in this communion, the dead continue to live. Or strive to. Instead, what she said to Brian was, just because it's unpleasant doesn't mean I get to avoid it. He didn't like it, but all he said was,
and then we gotta go.
How? He gestured toward the river.
I got a boat down there.
A boat?
Big boat. Get us to Halifax. You two will be out of the country in 2 days.
What'll you do?
Hide in plain sight.
He placed his palm to the crown of the baby's head and kissed the top of her ear.
You might have noticed I've got a knack for it.
She nodded. Maybe too much of one. He gave that a sad tilt of his head and said nothing.
If we don't make good time on the water, she asked, or if one of us gets injured, breaks an ankle or something. There's a backup plan for that.
How many backup plans do you have? He thought about it.
Quite a few.
What about me?
Hmm?
You got a backup plan for me? He stood across from her with the baby asleep on his shoulder, and he let the shotgun fall to the ground, and he touched a strand of her hair with his thumb and index finger.
There's no backup plan for you.
Eventually, she looked at the house behind him. I'm gonna go pay my respects.
I'll be waiting.
She left him and walked into the house. With all but one shade drawn, it was cool and dark in there. She paused at the base of the stairs. She pictured Haya's corpse, and her resolve wavered. She almost turned back. But then she pictured the Haya she'd seen in the bedroom this morning, the true person staring back at her for the first time through eyes as rich and black as the first night or the last. She marveled at her will, the resolve, the balls it took to become someone else so completely that the battle for dominance between the captive self and the captor self couldn't become anything but unwinnable. Each would surely subsume the other in a forever war, and no matter how it ended up, neither could ever return home. So it had been with Brian Alden, she realized, since the moment he'd donned the purloined coat of Brian Delacroix. And so it had been with Elizabeth Childs and Jeremy James and even Lee Grayson. At times in their lives, they'd been one version, and then they'd been other versions, and some of those versions had brushed up against Rachel and altered Rachel's life, or even given life to her. But then they'd gone on to be still other versions, and other people beyond that.
Then Elizabeth and Lee had gone even further, into the place where Haya now found herself, transformed yet again. And what of Rachel herself? What was she, if not forever in transit, forever en route?